darling. He's the ultimate.
Yeah! The ex-quotient. The new man. The common denominator. The main man. The head honcho. Bottom line, honey. Numero uno.
Where is he? How do I find him?
Catch this number, honey.
Broadcasting from Southside, Virginia to North Raleigh and all between. Welcome to the Alvin Augustus Jones Morning Show, where world leaders and thinkers come to chat.
The doctor's in the house.
I want to speak to your brother to brother.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
This is the story of a man who buried his identity to dedicate his life to the service of humanity and country. It is the story of an American heritage. The story of
Alvin, 6 foot two, shoulders out to here, and a smile that lit up the night.
I'm that man. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job that makes a man watchful and a little lonely.
Truth is, I only know one thing for sure.
I gotta do something. I gotta do something. Let's go to church.
Take me to the church. Okay.
This is Alvin Augustus Jones, and you on the Big Q, WCBQ 1348-90. We're going to talk to a young man who has written a very powerful book. The name of the book is The Coming Free, The Struggle for African-American Equality. His name is David Rubel, and he's written this powerful book that features so much information. It is impossible to begin to describe this heavy, thick, coffee table sized book that you definitely want to have in every home, not only to use for Black History Month, but you want to use it throughout the year to encourage yourself and young people to know about the struggles that African Americans have had over the years. My first question to him is, why did he decide to put together this extraordinary book?
As a writer, one hopes for great material, and there really isn't much better material out there than the story of the civil rights struggle.
This story has been done before. What is so unique about the method and style that you used?
Well, one thing that's unusual about this book is that it's highly illustrated. And we spent a great deal of time trying to find photos and other ephemera that people hadn't seen before. So as you look through the book, we hope that you'll find that the text and the images are so well integrated that you can that it really evokes the times that I'm writing about, so that you can get a feel for what it was like to be alive then and how people alive then felt.
Tell me something about the composite photograph that's on the cover of the book.
Well, that was actually a photograph that was found by our fabulous designer. And it is taken from a march that Dr. King participated in. And it is a close-up of people's linked hands. And the idea was that it was such a powerful statement of people coming together for a cause. And that's why we placed it on the cover of the book.
Your book opens up with one of the most powerful Sundays that ever took place. And it's not by chance that we have you here a week before that particular day in terms of commemoration. On March the 7th, 1965, they called it Bloody Sunday. Tell me about that particular event.
Well, that was the day that marchers left Selma, Alabama, and crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge and were beaten by the Alabama State Police, who fired tear gas at them, rushed the crowd with billy clubs, and sent countless people to the hospital. It was a day that precipitated such national outrage that Dr. King led a caravan of people into Selma because he was determined that the march would take place. He actually wasn't there on Bloody Sunday. He was back preaching in Atlanta and recovering from exhaustion, really. But he got on, I guess he drove immediately to Selma and sent out a national call for people all over the country to come. And they populated Selma for about a week. There was a court injunction that prevented them from marching. And Dr. King always had a problem with court orders. He used them so effectively to promote African-American political rights that he was very concerned about not obeying them even when they went against him. And so he decided that he wouldn't march until the court order was lifted. But when it finally was, it led to what many people think of was the greatest triumph of the civil rights movement, the march from Selma to Montgomery that took place 2 weeks later.
In fact, that particular discussion was surrounded by the foreword that was done by Congressman John Lewis. Tell me about the impact that John Lewis had on the civil rights movement and why you chose him to do the foreword of this particular book.
Congressman Lewis is one of those amazing characters in the book that people don't know nearly as much about as they should, and I'd add to that list people like Robert Moses as well. John Lewis was a young student in Nashville at the American Baptist Seminary when the students at Greensboro, in Greensboro at North Carolina A&T, staged what was the first major sit-in. There had been sit-ins before, but that was the one that stuck in February of 1960. And it amazed John Lewis, who had grown up just outside of Montgomery and had actually listened to Dr. King preach on the radio there growing up as a young boy. And he was so caught up in the idea of what such a protest meant, what nonviolent passive resistance could do, that he joined a group of Nashville students and started to do sit-ins in Nashville. And that group became the core of what turned into the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and John Lewis became its national chairman. And he rode that historical wave for many years and ended up in all the important places. It was sort of like the movie Zelig. He just showed up everywhere. And he was at the March on Washington, and as I'm sure many of your listeners know, he was going to give quite a fiery speech at the march, but President Kennedy insisted that he tone it down, and he was able to get people like Philip Randolph, who wanted to build consensus, to talk to young Mr. Lewis and get him to take out such phrases as, "We will march through Georgia like Sherman," which had very much upset the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Washington.
Throughout the book, not only do you give known facts and you, as you mentioned, give photographs and information that perhaps was not known, you also deal with some things that maybe perhaps are little known for individuals. Let's say, for example, in one section you call New Slavery. Tell me about this congressman, Blanche K. Bruce, and others during that time who were in Congress, in the halls of Congress during that period of time.
Most civil rights movement books tend to cover the period just from Brown v. Board of Ed in 1954 up through Selma, or perhaps the assassination of Dr. King. And what I chose to do was actually go back to the end of the Civil War, because the period of Reconstruction is so important to understand what came after it. And Blanche Bruce was one of, in fact, he was the first African-American elected to the Senate from Mississippi, I believe. And that was in a time right after the Civil War when Union troops were occupying the South and enforcing the voting rights of African Americans. And during that period, a number of blacks were elected to public office in the South. It turned out to be not a sustainable position because the Northerners who were providing the troops got tired of occupying the South. And after about 15 years, they wanted to leave. That was combined with increasing violence on the part of the Ku Klux Klan, which was formed in 1866 in Tennessee, to get the Northerners out. And by the time of the 1876 presidential election, the South was able to force the removal of the federal troops. And after that, blacks were really no longer allowed to vote. And that's when what I call the new slavery was reimposed. And you had things like the Black Codes. Segregation was imposed. The Supreme Court began to bend much further to the right on that and issued decisions like Plessy v. Ferguson, which legitimized the separate but equal doctrine, which of course was more separate than it was equal.
Some of the colorful stories that you feature in the book, and even also in that same section there, since we're there, let's do another one. Ida B. Wells and the Anti-Lynching Campaign. Tell me about that whole series of events.
Ida Wells is one of those really, truly remarkable women that one occasionally comes across in history. She was the child of slaves who had been trained and given a trade by their master. Once the Civil War came, they really wanted education for their daughter, and they sent her to Rust University, which was then essentially a school for teachers, and they wanted her to be a teacher. Both of her parents died when she was only about 13 or 14, and she ended up raising all of her brothers and sisters on a teacher's salary. She moved to Memphis, became involved with a local black newspaper there, and was very disturbed to learn the extent to which middle-class blacks really were being lynched in Memphis at the time. There was a fight between two grocery store owners, a white and a consortium of three black men who owned a different grocery store that was competing very well against the white store. And the white owner used the police to harass the black grocery store owners, and it led to a street fight, after which the black grocery store owners were lynched. Ida Wells wrote about this extensively in the Memphis Press Scimitar, which was the newspaper that she worked for. And she was so outspoken in her opposition that she was told if she ever returned to Memphis, she was actually touring the Northeast at the time, that she would be killed as well. So she never went back to Memphis for the rest of her life and instead stayed in New York and became a crusader against lynching.
Also, besides you going through the book and giving us colorful stories about great African-Americans as well as others who participated in the freedom or civil rights movement, a lot of little side information. For example, I'm looking on one page here where, during the section here where a young man is sitting in a room, and I believe it's called a anteroom during his stay at the University of Oklahoma. Tell me about this situation in this part of the book where this young man was in the room, but yet still he was not in a room to get his education.
Actually, that gentleman was about 68, and it's merely because of the fuzziness of photos from that time that you can't tell it. His name was George McLaurin, and during the mid-40s, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund was particularly concerned with what it called the university cases. It was trying to get African Americans into mainstream white universities, particularly state universities. And that's, in fact, what was part of the litigation that led up to the Brown decision. And Thurgood Marshall wanted to find someone whom he could use to sue the University of Oklahoma to gain admission. And he chose George McLaurin, who was an elderly, very intelligent gentleman. He perceived McLaurin as to be not threatening. There was, as I'm sure you know, particularly in the immediate aftermath of World War II, great fear among prejudiced whites of young black men. And George McLaurin had the virtue of being not physically threatening. And the case forced the University of Oklahoma to admit him. But in order to preserve segregation, they made Mr. McLaurin sit outside the classroom and listen to it from his own enclave. And they scheduled his classes in rooms where that could be done. That, of course, was eventually overturned, and black students were mainstreamed in the university system all over the country. But his story is one of the many that I particularly like to write about, because the writing, I think, is most effective when one can take a particular person and tell his or her story in a way that makes readers be able to identify with what it felt like at the time. And it's very easy for anybody to imagine the feelings that George McLaurin must have been going through his mind and his heart as he sat in that anteroom and listened to the professor through the door and not be allowed inside himself.
One thing that's very powerful about the book is that if a person looks at this book, there are a lot of powerful images in the book, especially when you get into the section concerning Emmett Till, you get into the section concerning lynching. Also, some of the language, if you are offended by the N-word, you may not want to buy the book because it's used in context for people to understand what took place during that period of time. There was one particular book that I thought was very fascinating. The book was written by Tom Brady called Black Monday. And one of the quotes you have is, "The social, economic, and the religious preferences of the Negro remain close to the caterpillar and the cockroach." Why don't you sprinkle throughout the book letters, poems, and writings from various individuals?
Well, once again, I felt that my mission in writing the book, since to a certain extent the large events are relatively well known, was to point out not only how those events came to take place, but also what the texture of them was like. I think it's very easy, even for people who lived through them, to forget 30, 40, 50 years later what it felt like to be alive then. And nothing quite does that by as quoting primary documents. When I do my historical research, I spend a lot of time reading what people at the time actually wrote rather than what historians have written later, because the flavor comes through so strongly. And one of the advantages of doing that research is wonderful quotes appear, not only highly eloquent quotes from people who were fighting injustice, but also quotes that give one the sense of what that injustice really was. And Tom Brady was a very well-known Mississippian who, in the wake of the Brown decision, wrote a pamphlet that was seized on by the white citizens' councils because it so cogently stated their case, as well as their prejudice. And, you know, people who didn't live through it find it hard to imagine what sort of things Emmett Till was up against in 1955. But if you read what Tom Brady had to say about black people, it becomes a lot more clear how killing a 14-year-old boy could be done so callously.
One of the most heartbreaking photographs in your book is an unidentified man on the balcony at the hotel kneeling over to cover the body of Dr. Martin Luther King and to see the blood that was coming out of his body. I don't think people understand the brutality of taking another person's life. Why would you show such images like that in your book?
Well, the common image that one sees is of either Dr. King speaking just before he was shot on that balcony, or there's one very famous one of Jesse Jackson and a number of other people pointing up to where they think the shooter was. And while those are both evocative, I chose to use that particular picture you mentioned because I thought that what's often lost in both of those is, as you say, the brutality of what happened. And if you don't see the body there, I think that the real force of what assassination means can be lost.
We're talking to the author of this powerful book, The Coming Free, The Struggle for African-American Equality. Tell me how I can get a copy of the book. If I want to stay in communication with you, how I can do so. And give me a closing comment concerning the importance of this vital book, The Coming Free.
Well, the book, as I believe, is available in most bookstores as well as online at places like Amazon. I can be contacted through the publisher. And I think that I hope that readers feel as privileged to know the story as I felt to write it.
Paradise. Traditional inspiration for the soul. Paradise.